Thursday, August 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Joe Biden's running mate, Kamala Harris, introduces herself to the nation in night three of the Democratic National Convention. The latest on the situation in Mali following a mutiny that disbanded the government.
If you look at the evidence just on the ground, people did welcome the move, but the people did welcome the move not necessarily because they want military rule, but because they're absolutely fed up with the government that has now departed.
Also ahead, big name musical performances at Wednesday night's Democratic convention. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Senator Kamala Harris gave the most important speech of her political career Wednesday night, addressing the Democratic National Convention as presidential nominee Joe Biden's running mate. The former prosecutor from California, who made history as the first Black woman and Asian American on a major presidential ticket, aggressively pressed the case against President Donald Trump, against Republican President Donald Trump's reelection on November 3rd. And joining us now for more details on night three of the convention is VOA's Steve Reddish. Steve, this was really an introduction of sorts for Kamala Harris on the national stage, even though many people know her, others may not. What was her message?
The overall message she was trying to convey is that she is much like the American community at large, a community made up of immigrants and a diverse group of people. She's trying to take that and make the case that she and Joe Biden have a vision of the country as a place where everyone is welcome, no matter what they look like, no matter where they come from, no matter who they love. She made a point of saying that. And that while she and Biden don't necessarily agree on every single detail, just like every American doesn't agree on every single detail of policy, but as a community, there's an opportunity to try and bring the country, a divided country, together. And that, I think, was her basic message, that she and Biden, because of their common backgrounds, hers as a daughter of immigrants and his having overcome the grief of losing his wife and daughter, that the combination will be able to help heal the divisions that exist in the country.
Former President Barack Obama, clearly one of the most popular people in the Democratic Party, what was his message?
Barack Obama is the most recent former Democratic president, and he still has a kind of power over the party, and the party still looks at him as its leader. And Obama made it clear to really target President Trump. He said that Trump might want to try and show some interest in doing the job seriously, but he never did. Obama was very pointed in his attacks on Trump.
And what did he say about his own vice president, Joe Biden?
President Obama was effusive in his praise for his former vice president. He said that when he was searching for a running mate 12 years ago, he didn't realize he would come upon a brother. And he said, despite the differences in their ages and where they came from, he learned that Joe Biden has the respect of many, many people, and he gives respect and dignity to every person that he meets. He said, as well, Joe Biden was the last one in the room whenever he made a big decision, and that had made him a better president.
VOA's Steve Reddish, thanks so much. At a news conference earlier in the day Wednesday, President Donald Trump pushed back on the reproach from former President Barack Obama. Trump said he went to Washington to clean up after the Obama-Biden administration.
President Obama did not do a good job, and the reason I'm here is because of President Obama and Joe Biden. Because if they did a good job, I wouldn't be here. And probably if they did a good job, I wouldn't have even run. I would have been very happy. I enjoyed my previous life very much.
At next week's Republican National Convention, President Trump and his party will seek to convince Americans that their candidate is deserving of a second term and that Joe Biden is not up for the job. The pandemic is driving many Americans to voting by mail in this November's presidential election, but congressional Democrats say the Trump administration's recent changes at the U.S. Postal Service could lead to voter suppression. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins us to explain the controversy.
All of this really started when a new postmaster general came in earlier this summer, appointed by President Trump, and he actually has some ties with the Republican Party and President Trump. He was one of their major donors and fundraisers before he was put in this key position overseeing the U.S. Postal Service, he had actually announced some changes that would have removed processing facilities, those blue mail collection boxes that we see on every street corner in the United States, as well as making some changes to the hours of the post office and the ability of postal employees who are already overworked as it is, claiming overtime so that they can deliver all the mail on time. Once he announced those changes, many congressional Democrats said, look, this is going to be a terrible time to institute these changes because we know that the Postal Service is about to get overwhelmed by a historic amount of mail-in ballots in this upcoming November election. This is not the time to be making those changes. The fact that you're making those changes probably means that you're trying to interfere with the upcoming election and make sure that all of those mail-in ballots don't get in on time and don't get counted. Attorney generals in 20 Democratic states across the nation have already filed lawsuits against the Postmaster General, alleging that these delays, because of the removal of the processing machines and other elements of the Postal Service, have really damaged the people in their states, and they want to pursue this in tandem with all the protests that are spreading up around the country.
I presume that the Trump administration and the Postmaster General, Mr. DeJoy, did not expect the uproar across the nation. How unprecedented is all of this, and what is Congress doing now to make sure that changes that have been detrimental to the mail service are reversed?
Right. Well, I think that a lot of Americans really haven't thought that much and in this much detail about the U.S. Postal Service before, even though it's something that people use a lot in their everyday lives, they don't really devote a lot of time and thought to how much we use it and how desperately we do need it when there are times like mail-in voting. A lot of people use it to get their medications. And of course, with the rise of online shopping and other services, a lot of people get their groceries and other important things through the mail. That's just something that's a fact of life. So when people realized that the mail was indeed slowing down, they definitely went out, started protesting. Congressional Democrats said that they're going to come back into town and push through some legislation that might give some additional funding to the U.S. Postal Service. And in the face of that uproar, the Postmaster General said that he would not be instituting any of those changes until after Election Day. Congressional Democrats said that, look, you know, obviously what we were saying made this happen, but we still need to be on guard. We still need to come back into town to make sure that that funding is passed, to make sure that this doesn't happen again and doesn't happen leading up to November.
What about concerns over these major sorting machines that made it possible for mail delivery on time? Mailboxes in specific neighborhoods that were removed. Are they also planning to address that when he appears before Congress?
So he's going to be coming before the Republican majority U.S. Senate Friday and then the Democratic majority U.S. House early next week. And he'll definitely be getting questions about where those already removed machines went to. Some early media reporting is showing that some of them may have already been destroyed. So some of the damage may already have been done. And that's why congressional Democrats want to pass that legislation to make sure that the Postal Service is funded and has funds available to try and replace some of this lost capacity. A lot of congressional Democrats have come out and said, we all know that tampering with elements of the U.S. Postal Service is actually a federal offense. That's something that you legally cannot do in this country. And so there's possibly a severe legal issue that if these processing machines were destroyed, that's something that's going to have to be pursued in addition to those lawsuits alleging that the mail delays harmed people in those states.
Lawmakers have said, even if the changes are reversed, what do we do about voter confidence?
In part, I think that's why Nancy Pelosi is still calling the U.S. House back for an emergency vote later this week. She wants people to see that U.S. lawmakers are doing something about this issue and are going to stay on top of it. If it backtracks or degrades, or there are any additional concerns coming from the U.S. Postal Service, Nancy Pelosi basically, by bringing lawmakers back, is saying, look, we're going to be on top of this.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson, thanks so much.
Soldiers who staged a military coup in Mali, leading to the resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and his government, said Wednesday they plan to form a civilian transitional government that will organize fresh elections. Keita resigned and dissolved parliament late on Tuesday, hours after mutinying soldiers detained him at gunpoint, plunging a country already facing a jihadist insurgency and mass protests deeper into crisis. Joining us now for the latest is Mali-based reporter Bram Posthumus. Thank you so much for being with us. So what's the latest on the ground following all of this?
What I'm hearing is that Bamako is calm. Even Kati, where it all started yesterday morning, is calm. It's quite clear that the government, the new government, sometimes called the junta already, wants people to go about their business as per the usual, so that they really don't want any more disruption. I mean, remember that we're already having a corona epidemic, which has disrupted business. We've had demonstrations, political manifestations, which have disrupted the business. So they really want to start or restart things as normal as quickly as possible. The big question is, of course, whether they're going to be heeded and whether they're going to achieve this return to normality ASAP.
The mutineers are denying any reports of casualties following the unrest, but Amnesty International is disputing that, saying there were at least 4 people killed in all of it and 15 more wounded by bullets. Do you have any information on who is correct here?
No, I don't actually, because there is a lot of confusion about what actually happened. I mean, the claim from the mutineers or the new junta is that there was shooting, but there was vertical shooting into the air, and maybe people could have been hit by stray bullets. There doesn't seem to be anything to suggest that in this particular case, people have been shot at point blank deliberately, as was the case in July when the demonstrations happened in downtown Bamako. So, yes, we've got competing claims, and at this particular point in time, it's very hard to say who's got the correct information.
There have been a number of nations, including France, condemning the actions of the military. It would seem, though, that the protesters, or at least the citizens in Mali, were actually looking to get rid of the president and this government. Is that an accurate statement? Why the military getting involved when the protesters were already out on the streets?
Well, these are competing interests, really, you're looking at. You know, the protesters were on about the fact that there was a lot of corruption at the level of the government, that the security situation wasn't improving in the country, and the army has got a couple of particular things to add to this. Very, very clearly, they're still unhappy about the kind of equipment they can use, which is old and in dire need of being renewed. The other thing is obviously the issue of payment, you know, the payment of soldiers who are being sent out to the front to fight a war with an almost invisible enemy are getting pay the pittance. All these things play their part in the movement of contestation against the government. I think from the military side, these complaints were quite clear and quite easy to identify. Yes, conditions of work. The head of the presidential guard was fired on the eve of the coup. That probably didn't go down very well either. Whereas the political side, the protesters in the streets in downtown Bamako, did have a much more broader list of complaints, you know, non-delivery of services, the presence of the French on their territory, the presence of the United Nations on their territory. And so it's not necessarily the case that these two agendas dovetail. And I think what happened yesterday is that the military said, okay, we have a problem with you, the government, you don't listen. Okay, we are removing the problem by removing you.
Would that mean that the people out there protesting are okay with what the military has done?
It's obviously circumstantial evidence because we haven't got a real poll asking everybody around Mali what they think of these latest events. But yeah, definitely, I mean, if you look at the evidence just on the ground, people did welcome the move, but people did welcome the move not necessarily because they want military rule, but because they're absolutely fed up with the government that has now departed. And precisely for the reasons I mentioned earlier, the bad hospitals, the bad education, the terrible situation with supply of water and electricity, the bad roads. I mean, the roads in Bamako, it's the rainy season right now, have been washed away. You cannot move on a tarred road because the tar has disappeared. So all these things add up. And it's not just Bamako, it's also in other parts of the country where there have been similar protests about similar issues. Although I have to say that these events that we have witnessed in these past 48 hours towers have been very much centered on the capital city, Bamako.
The UN Security Council has been demanding the release of all the government officials. Has that happened?
No, to the best of my knowledge, it hasn't. There's been obviously the most prominent one being President, ex-President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, who released a statement late last night saying that he was actually resigning from his job. What's happened to the others, including Prime Minister Boubou Cisse and others, we quite clearly don't know. They will probably be released because it doesn't appear to be a coup whereby the military have adopted an extremely antagonistic attitude towards the authorities that they've deposed. They just say, well, we have a problem with you, we want you out, so you've gone, and then we'll see, we'll take it from there. To be perfectly honest, I think in this particular case, the UN was more or less jumping the gun because this will be sorted out the Mali way.
Mali-based reporter Bram Posthumus. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko ordered his police on Wednesday to put down protests in the capital, Minsk, signaling an escalation after a week and a half of mass demonstrations against his rule. The European Union held talks Wednesday on the situation in Belarus, where protesters continue to demand Lukashenko resign. International Edition's Steve Miller speaks to reporter Catherine Field in Paris for the latest.
The key point from this meeting has been that the EU, that's the 27 members of the EU, consider that the elections were, and I quote, neither free nor fair, and that they do not recognize the results. The situation, they all said, is increasingly concerning to them, and that is because they are concerned of any violence. Let's not forget, Belarus is right on the eastern flank of the European Union's member states. They do not want uncertainty, they do not want violence, they do not want unrest on that eastern flank. So they're concerned about violence as much as they are about the rule of law and the democratic aspirations of the people of Belarus.
So what can they do?
It's very difficult for them. If they go too far, then they risk upsetting the Russian President Vladimir Putin, who, of course, does consider Belarus to be his, what the Russians call their near abroad, their very clear sphere of influence. So what they are doing, the European Union has said that they will have targeted sanctions against individuals they consider responsible for the violence that followed the elections and for those who are responsible for the falsification of the elections. They are not going to be sanctioning all the leaders just outright. It's going to be very targeted, specific people. They say that they will come up with this list in the next few days.
So I guess the big question is, how does this affect the European Union as a whole?
It's a real concern for the European Union that they do have this eastern flank that is not really within its orbit, so to speak, that it's not being influenced, if you like, by the European Union over the decades talking about the need for Europe to all be having a respect for the individual and a respect for the electoral process. And I think the fact that you also see that at this meeting today, the leaders agreed that they will put 53 million euros into the Belarus civil society to help them and not directly to the Belarus government. I think that's interesting to see yet again. We saw that in the Lebanon, we're seeing it here in Belarus, that they're going directly to civil organizations, civil society, not governments. And that's very important because they're essentially saying, we don't like what you're doing and we're not going to deal with you, but we are going to deal with your population. And in that we've seen they're going to give 50 million euros to the health service to help engaging with COVID. They're also going to give 2 million euros to help the victims of repression in that country. And they're going to give 1 million euros for civil society groups. These civil society groups who talk about fundamental democracy and freedom and who are there on the ground helping to make that peaceful democratic transition happen.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. The massive American warship, the USS Herschel Woody Williams, has arrived at the Greek island of Crete on a mission to keep an eye on escalating tensions between NATO allies, Greece, and Turkey over energy rights in the eastern Mediterranean. The U.S. vessel joins others from the European Union and Russia, raising concerns among some in Greece about what a military buildup could mean. Anthi Karasava reports from Athens.
Military experts describe the USS Herschel Woody Williams as a floating base, the second of a new class of massive ships the U.S. Navy is now using as fast transport and support centers for military operations. The 230-meter-long ship, about the size of some skyscrapers, was earlier in Naples, Italy, for a routine logistics stop before it was sent to Crete, where it is on standby as Greece and Turkey remain locked in a standoff. Greek and Turkish battleships have been gathering in the region since President Recep Tayyip Erdogan ordered a research vessel to the Eastern Mediterranean to survey for gas and oil. Greece says the seabed off the coast of Crete and other islands in the region are its own to exploit, a claim Turkey has repeatedly refused, saying islands are not entitled to what is known as an exclusive economic zone. U.S. officials have not given details on the orders the Herschel Woody Williams received or how long it will remain in Crete's Souda Bay. But its presence comes as France last week also deployed a pair of frigates to the Eastern Mediterranean, a move that quickly drew Moscow's attention. The Russian Navy moved in with one of its frigates. Cyprus Foreign Minister Nikos Christodoulidis says forces from other EU nations and countries in the region are likely to arrive and join the effort. He says it is something Greek officials are expecting to build up as they try to find a diplomatic solution. He praised the build-up as vivid proof of the West's resolve to block what he said is Turkey's growing influence in the region. Analyst Kosas Ifadis, a professor of military studies and diplomatic relations, doubts the show of force will change things very much. He says that if the situation gets dicey, we may see other countries like Egypt mobilizing. But from the EU standpoint, he says, it is unlikely that this buildup will impact Turkey because its biggest trading partner and closest ally, Germany, is unlikely to join in such a maneuver. Currently chairing the EU's rotating presidency, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been trying to convince Athens and Ankara to enter into negotiations over the conflicting claims each side has to air and sea rights in the region. Germany has been reluctant to support stiff sanctions against Turkey, but it has advised the government in Ankara to pull back its survey vessel from the disputed waters. Turkey has said it will continue to survey the contested region throughout next week. But the buildup of vessels, submarines, and even combat aircraft in the region has experts fearing an accident that could spark a bigger confrontation between Greece and Turkey. In a recent incident, Greek Defense Ministry officials said a Greek frigate collided with the rear of a Turkish ship as the Greek vessel moved to intercept it. There was no damage to either vessel, but the incident prompted armed forces on both sides to be on heightened alert. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Lebanon's leading Sunni cleric Wednesday joined calls for early parliamentary elections and an international investigation into the explosion at Beirut port earlier this month. At least 179 people were killed and 300,000 left effectively homeless when massive amounts of highly explosive material stored unsafely for years detonated. It destroyed large parts of the city and led to massive protests and government leadership resignation. Pope Francis said Wednesday that rich countries should not hoard a coronavirus vaccine and should only give pandemic-related bailouts to companies committed to protecting the environment, helping the most needy, and the common good. He said it should not become property of any one nation, rather universal and available for everyone. The United States is demanding that all UN sanctions be reimposed against Iran, a move that follows America's failure to extend an arms embargo against Tehran. President Trump says Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will travel to New York today to notify the Security Council president that the U.S. is invoking the so-called snapback mechanism in the Council's resolution that endorsed the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. But other nations claim the U.S. has no standing to make the move because the Trump administration pulled the U.S. out of the deal 2 years ago. You're listening to International Edition, back in a minute.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
VOA's International Edition continues. The United Nations reports humanitarian workers are facing unprecedented levels of violence while putting their own lives at risk in order to provide life-saving aid to millions of civilians caught in situations of crisis. This year's World Humanitarian Day honors and pays tributes to these thousands of unsung real-life heroes. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
World Humanitarian Day was created in the aftermath of the terrorist attack on the UN compound in Baghdad on August 19, 2003. 22 people were killed, including the Secretary General's Special Representative for Iraq, Sergio Vieira de Mello. Since then, nearly 5,000 aid workers have been killed, wounded, or abducted. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, tells VOA humanitarian workers in 2019 were subjected to a record number of attacks in conflict zones around the world.
Last year, there was a total of 483 aid workers who were targeted in the fields where they are doing their life-saving work. 125 of them were killed in the line of duty, and the same number were kidnapped, and many more were wounded.
The UN reports most of the attacks occurred in Syria, followed by South Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Afghanistan, and the Central African Republic. Laerke says every time aid workers are targeted, it has a ripple effect on the population they are trying to help.
The vast majority of aid workers on the front lines, those aid workers that we are calling the real heroes of the day, are nationals of the country where they work. Very often they're members of the same communities that they are helping. Some are refugees helping their fellow displaced people or even the host communities where they are. Others are local doctors and nurses offering their services free of charge.
Still others, he says, are international aid workers who jump from crisis to crisis. Humanitarian agencies warn delivering aid has become even more dangerous in the current coronavirus pandemic. The International Committee of the Red Cross has documented more than 600 incidents of violence, harassment, or stigmatization against healthcare workers, patients, and medical infrastructure in relation to COVID-19 cases during the first 6 months of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Along with top political stars, America's Democratic and Republican conventions always include musical performances. Wednesday, Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Billie Eilish and Academy Award-winning actress and singer Jennifer Hudson joined the party for the third night of the Democratic National Convention. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening and have a great day.